When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with Andrea Penrose about Murder at the Royal Botanic Gardens, the fifth in her Lord Rexford and Lady Charlotte Sloane series. It's something of a happy accident that I've encountered so many remarkable historical mysteries recently. I stumbled over this one through an online recommendation and was instantly hooked. The time period, Regency England, is one I grew up with as a diehard Georgette Heyer fan, but Andrea Penrose's Regency London couldn't be more different from Heyer's, or Austen's, if you're a Jane Austen devotee. Most interesting, as we'll discuss, is Penrose's focus on the scientific developments of the time, from steam engines to primitive computers, and how those inventions drive her intricate but satisfying plots. Even more compelling are the complex and fascinating characters, especially the leads, the Earl of Rexford and Lady Charlotte Sloane, who began the series as reluctant co-investigators and are now planning their wedding. Until, of course, an unexpected corpse appears. Prologue. The floral fragrances, a symphony of subtle sweetness, swirled with the earthier scents of mist-damp leaves and the nutrient-rich soil. The gentleman closed his eyes for a moment and drew in a deep breath. The essence of life. There was nothing more beautiful, Josiah Beckton mused, as he stood very still in the shadows and let the warm air caress his cheeks. Moonlight flickered through the soaring glass-paned walls of the magnificent conservatory, its silvery softness twining with the gold-hued glow of the lanterns hung among the exotic greenery. The faint sounds of a string quartet, was it Mozart or Haydn, floated out from the assembly room attached to the rambling structure, the lilting notes punctuated by discreet laughter and the crystalline click of champagne glasses. It was all so elegantly civilized, this international symposium of botany scholars and wealthy patrons of science, gathered at London's legendary Royal Botanic Gardens in order to share their knowledge for the good of mankind. And now, please join me in welcoming Andrea Penrose. Hi, Andrea. Thanks for agreeing to talk with me today.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thanks for asking.
Although we're going to focus on your Rexford and Sloane series today, you have a previous series that features Lady Arianna Hadley. I've read several of those books, and they fascinate me in part because there seem to be character overlaps between them and the Rexford and Sloane novels. Most notably, Basil Henning appears in both, but there are subtler links as well. Could you talk about the genesis and development of Lady Arianna?
I would love to. But first, as a bit of backstory, I thought it might be helpful if I explain why I love the Regency and setting my novels in that era. For me, it's such a fabulously interesting time and place. It's a world, a swirl and silk, seduction, intrigue of the Napoleonic Wars. Radical new ideas were clashing with conventional thinking of the past. People were questioning the fundamentals of society. As a result, they were fomenting changes in every aspect of life, sort of politics, art, music, science, social rules. The world was really turning upside down. You had Romanticism taking hold with Beethoven composing emotional symphonies, Byron writing wildly romantic poetry, Turner dabbling in impressionistic watercolors, Mary Wollstonecraft writing the first feminist manifestos. And then technology was disrupting everyday life as the Industrial Revolution began to crank into high gear. Interest in science was exploding as people were looking around at the world and wanting to understand how it worked. Geology, the workings of the heavens, the mysteries of the sea. It's in so many ways, it's the birth of the modern world. And for me, its challenges and its characters, its conflicts have such relevance to our own times. Hey, I mean, we all find change is frightening. I like writing about people who are both strong and vulnerable. We all have strengths and weaknesses, and how we learn to balance those conflicting elements is, to me, sort of an integral part of the human experience. And an author can, of course, play with these tensions in any era, but for me, the Regency presents a particularly interesting time in which to do it. As for Lady Ariana, it's interesting. It came about, I was brainstorming ideas for a mystery series with my agent, and I wanted to move into mystery as I felt a series of link books gave more opportunity to develop characters in a more nuanced and complex way than a single book about a hero and heroine where the love story is the main focus of the plot. And I had stumbled across some fascinating facts about the history of chocolate, which is a whole topic for another podcast. And my agent thought, what about a heroine with an expertise in chocolate? So I began pondering. I think what she had in mind was a light, cozy series with a woman as a proprietor of a chocolate shop and through her customers became involved in solving mysteries. So I think she didn't quite expect the concept I came up for, Lady Ariana, but she liked it. Lady Ariana is the daughter of a disgraced earl who's forced to flee to the West Indies to escape prosecution in England for a financial fraud. He's been framed to take the full blame by his co-conspirators. She's grown up in poverty, and then when her father is murdered when she's fairly young, she has reason to suspect that his co-conspirators wanted to silence him. So she decides to come back to London and seek revenge and clear his name. Disguised as a man, she gets a job cooking in an aristocratic household, which allows her entree into the world of the beau monde. But when the Prince Regent falls ill after eating one of her chocolate desserts, the government gets involved, sends a former military officer to investigate. They have a very heated confrontation, but they quickly discover that there is some dark conspiracy afoot and that perhaps both of them are being used as pawns. And to save herself from arrest, Ariana offers to serve as bait to get to the root of what's going on. And so the hunt is on. The Lady Ariana books focus more on the political intrigue of the era, which is fascinating because of the Napoleonic Wars and the butting of heads with America. But in Rexford and Sloane, it takes sort of a different tact.
Yes, let's talk about that. What gave rise then to the Rexford and Sloane novels? Because you're still publishing Lady Ariana, right? Or republishing?
I am. I actually am continuing them as self-pub. The first three were done at Putnam Penguin, and then they cut down on their line. And I enjoyed writing them so much that I decided to continue writing and self-publish the next titles, and a new one will be out next spring.
Oh, I can't wait. I still have three or four of those to go through. I've read all of the Rexford and Sloanes, but it's good to know that they're there's a steady diet, so to speak, especially with the chocolate.
There will be coming.
Great. So tell us about Rexford and Sloane.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned when I was talking about the Regency, I've become fascinated in technology and how it was frightening and disrupting society in Regency times. It seemed like such an interesting parallel to our own times that I just thought it would be a really compelling theme to use, which actually is very amusing since I haven't taken a science course since, ninth grade biology. So it's odd that I became entranced, but I just think it how people confront change and fear it makes for a wonderful time to set a mystery.
No, I agree. I think it works very well. And we will talk about some of the specific sciences that are covered later on. But let's talk first about the characters, starting with the Earl of Rexford, who is the first person we meet after the prologue where the murder is.
Right, right. Well, Rexford is a rich, bored, irascible aristocrat, but he's a brilliant man of science and possesses the ability to look at problems with a coldly dispassionate logic. Now, he takes great pride in being a rational man, you know, above the messiness of emotions. He just thinks absolutely steel trap logic. And then he meets Charlotte, you know. So I've had a lot of fun confronting him with his own preconceptions about an orderly life and having him slowly discover other facets of his character. Now, what is really interesting, too, is much is made about the constraints on women in the Regency, the rules, the strictures. But what I'm basing Rexford on, it's because the real truth is many aristocratic men felt just as constrained as women did by the strictures of society. If you were an aristocrat, you couldn't work for a living. So they really had difficulty exercising their talents. If they were bright and inquisitive, he'd be shunned for society for soiling his hands in trade. It's one of the reasons why so many bright and inquisitive men who could afford it became amateur men of science. Excuse me. And I avoid using the word scientist as it wasn't invented until 1833, which is the tail end of the Regency. But it's these men, people like Charles Babbage, who invented the first computer, and Henry Cavendish, who discovered hydrogen, captured that spirit of intellectual curiosity. It was the only way for men to challenge their minds. The alternative was drinking, gambling, and wenching their way to an early death, which, of course, many of them did.
I think that's a very good point. It's true, typically throughout history, I mean, men have traditionally wielded more power. But, you know, the men that I write about, for example, have to be warriors because of their class. They don't have a choice. If they happen to be artistic or they happen to be something else, tough luck.
It's so fascinating. In the Regency, if you were born to the aristocracy and you were a second son, the first son, of course, inherits all the lands. And so he can actually run an estate if it's a large, he has those challenges. But if you're a younger son, you can join the army, you can be a diplomat, or you can go into the church. And a lot of the very bright men became clerics, you know, or country curates or reverends, because they had a lot of free time to think and to putter and to explore the things that interested them, you know, like different sciences, or they became historians. They would write, they were able to write, you know, novels or history books. So it really was a very constricted life. It seems like it's golden, but there were real challenges.
When we first meet Rexford, his wrath, and you mentioned he is irascible, is directed at a satirist known as A.J. Quill. And we soon discover in that first novel, so it's not really a spoiler, that A.J. Quill is the pen name of Charlotte Sloane, whom you just mentioned. Talk about Charlotte. She is such a sweet character.
Well, Charlotte has taken up the pen of her late husband. They were struggling. He was a painter, an artist. So, and she finds she's even better at social commentary than he was. The nom de plume keeps her real identity a secret because, of course, a woman would never be allowed to criticize the leaders of society. And it also allowed her to earn money to live on her own terms. Now, in the Regency, the real-life satirical artists were the sharp-eyed, sharp-tongued social commentators. They're the equivalent of Trevor Noah, Jimmy Kimmel, Saturday Night Live. And in real life, the individual artists became very well known and were celebrities in their own right. They created these wonderfully large, beautifully detailed colored prints, which were sold every morning at the local print shops, but the general public would gather around the display windows to look at them, like we look at the morning newspaper, to see what was really going on in society, because the satirists all had their web of informants, you know, servants and people they could get inside information from. And then they would poke fun at the high and mighty and lambast political leaders, skewering their foibles and making public their scandals. So Charlotte is very clever and very insightful and is very good at doing this. But her network for learning secrets also proves invaluable when she's drawn into solving a crime.
Yes, and one of the ways she's drawn into solving the crime is because one of the things that differentiates her quite a bit from Lady Ariana is that she's living with these two urchins who, at least at the beginning, have just kind of taken up residence in her foyer, which she is allowing them to do. And it's such a nice element of the story, Raven and Hawk. So tell us a bit about them.
Well, you know, I wanted to create a world for my characters that was a little more true to actual history and not just show the fairy tale world of glittering ballrooms and fancy mansions and elegant silks and satins. Life was really challenging for most of the people of that era. And Charlotte and the boys are really kindred spirits. They're orphans who've managed to survive in the slums, which means they're really clever and smart and resilient. And so is Charlotte. So they really... That first draws them together. They're all three of them are fiercely independent, and they're a little wary of letting others get too close because they've learned they have to protect themselves. So I wanted, by bringing them together, I also wanted to show that in hard times, love and family, because they do forge their own eccentric little family, are powerful forces against darkness. I guess, you know, at heart, I'm a romantic, and I believe that good will triumph over evil.
There are quite a few important secondary characters in this series, and some of them are present from the very beginning. Rexford's friend Kit Sheffield, Tyler, who is Rexford's valet, Basil Hemming, whom I mentioned before. Others work their way in over time, such as Tyler's cousin McClellan, Charlotte's great-aunt Allison. Do you have a favorite or two? And if so, why? Why did you pick that person?
That's not fair. You know, all the secondary characters have a special place, you know, in my heart. But I do have to say, Sheffield was particularly fun. I fully intended him in the first book just to be a charming fribble, you know, kind of a comic foil for Rexford's seriousness. He would lighten moments or, you know, add some humor to the scenes. But lo and behold, he totally surprised me. He refused to play the fool. Now, he shows some hints of his depth in the first book, but there's a scene in the second where he really put his foot down and told me in no uncertain terms that he was far smarter and had far more character than I first imagined. So it's been really fun to develop him. And one of the elements I've played with is that when you first meet him, he's really bad at gambling. I mean, Rexford tears his hair out. Kid, how can you be this bad? You've got to be smarter. And how he gets better at it has been great fun to do. I won't give any spoilers.
No, don't give spoilers. But I do love how characters do that. I mean, a lot of my best characters started off as people I was, you know, I thought I was going to blame a crime on them, and then they were going to go.
Exactly. Isn't it funny how they really do take, I mean, people think you're crazy when you say that to them. What do you mean they have a mind of their own? You're making them up. But it is, it's amazing.
Right. Even the dialogue and everything. I mean, so the stuff that comes out of some of my characters' mouths, I'm like, where'd you get that?
Yeah, exactly. I have it. There are times when I push back, you know, my chair from writing for the day and say, I didn't know they were going to do that. I had no idea.
No, that's why you have to talk to other writers, because they're not quite so ready to call me.
That is so true.
They're professionals, right?
Yeah. When you get with a group of authors, you do say, oh, at last somebody understands what I'm talking about. They think, you know, other friends just sort of say, well, you just sit down and the book just sort of happens, you know, comes out. It's really easy, isn't it? Especially once you've done one and you want to say, oh, my God, you have no idea.
Well, not just that, but
the challenge.
The only time I ever had writer's block, serious writer's block, was when I was trying to force a character to do something she just didn't want to do. I mean, I know that sounds completely nuts, but as soon as I said no, she would not do that. She just would not do that. And it all opened up again. I mean, it's a real, I don't know where it comes from, the subconscious somewhere, I guess, but it is a real phenomenon.
It is absolutely. You're trying to push a scene and you're going, this just isn't working. What is wrong with it? And you're right. Sometimes you just say, because they wouldn't do that. They just, you know, he wouldn't do that. She wouldn't do that. And it's really fascinating.
It is fascinating. So actually, you don't have to pick just one. Tyler is a favorite of mine. So tell us a little bit about Tyler before we move on.
Well, Tyler is, he's one of the few people who can, who's not intimidated by the Earl, Lord Rexford. And he enjoys bantering. They both enjoy bantering, even though Rexford is very snarky at times. But they have a very a good relationship. And he shows his mettle in a number of the mysteries too. What I try, the secondary characters all have their strengths, and they do contribute some more, you know, depending on which book, on being very involved in helping to find the key clues that are going to solve the mystery. You know, Allison has been fun too, because you don't see elderly characters in novels that are allowed to really be sensible, I find. You know, a lot of times they're used sort of as daughterial, just elements, sometimes humorous. And I think I have fun showing wisdom and experience is really helpful. And she plays a role in really counseling Charlotte sometimes. And she's also finding out that she really enjoys this sleuthing stuff too. In fact, she worries Charlotte and Rexford a little bit. She's getting a little too enthusiastic about involving herself in danger. So she's fun.
She's a great character. I really like her too. And she leads right into my next point, which is that there are a lot of very intelligent, strong, motivated women, which is neat in itself. I like that. But also, I like the way that many of the men in your books, even men who turn out to be villains, are able to cope with these women and be supportive of them.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. It's as I was saying, the Regency, you have the fairy tale aspect, the ballroom, and all, everything was manners and very constricted. But in real life, I remember seeing an exhibit at the of portraits from the National Portrait Gallery in London. It was called Romantics and Revolutionaries, and it featured a selection of Regency portraits. And I was just riveted by the women that were shown and their stories. They were artists, poets, explorers, chemists, mathematicians, But what they all had in common was the courage to defy convention and pursue their passions. And that was a hallmark of more so than you think in the Regency. There were women who were really pressing the traditional role of women. Not a lot of them, I mean, but enough that they really, it's, I feel I can be true to life writing these strong women who are taking chances and doing, pushing the envelope a bit. And I think there were men in real life who supported them and admired their intellect. So again, it's, I'm really trying to stay true to what did happen back then, but put my own twist on it.
And one of the things, or one of the areas where these women are involved is in the sciences. So as we mentioned, because it's a mystery series, we don't want to give away the stories to the individual books. I would say it's probably a good idea for readers to read them in order, because one of the things that happens is that the Rexford-Sloan relationship develops over time. So if you start at the end, then they're already in a place and you didn't get to see them get there. And the fun is watching them make the changes. But the so let's talk a little bit about the science. We have alchemy slash chemistry in the first one. We have steam power in the second one. Electricity in the third one, including the sort of Frankenstein version of electricity being used to stimulate life. And I was so proud of myself because I figured that, not the whole thing out, but I figured out that that was what the electricity was doing there about halfway through. That was the first time in reading your books that I actually got ahead of you just a teensiest bit. And then Murder at Queen's Landing does mathematics and computing and even sort of early calculating, which, of course, was a Regency thing with Ada Lovelace and people like that. But how do you pick these areas and then decide, how do you decide how to turn them into a criminal, you know, mystery series?
Well, it you know, they sort of, they're so interesting in their own right. It's kind of, you know, I do a lot of deep reading if I decide, you know, chemistry, that's interesting. Or I knew alchemy was, a lot of the early scientists before the Regency, modern chemistry sort of developed out of alchemy and how they began to sort of say, this is a little probably off the rails, but this is reasonable. And I, in doing some reading, I hit on formulas for explosives and gunpowder, and you began to realize the practical applications of chemistry in the Regency had repercussions. The army was doing research, chemical research. They were so there were a lot of things. I think I got interested because it's so, there are just a lot of practical for all of the sciences that I use. It had a real, it's not just sort of abstract, but there were ways they were trying to use it to affect everyday life, whether it be war or the Industrial Revolution with the steam power. So I when I sort of look at what are some of the major trends in science, it's sort of easy to pick a MacGuffin, in a sense, for a mystery. You know, the first one is the chemistry. The steam power is easy because steam engines, again, engineering was happening, improvements for making more powerful machines. And that's when I started reading about patent wars like we have today. They did in the Regency too. If someone, an inventor, patented an improvement to an engine, he could make a lot of money off of that, just like our high-tech entrepreneurs do today. So again, they're wonderful synergies between what was going on then and what is going on now.
And what can you reveal about Murder at the Royal Botanic Gardens? That peaceful scene I read in the introduction soon gives way to serious trouble.
Yes. Who would have thought that a symposium of botanical scholars would result in murder and mayhem? But like today, you know, having a patent on a life-saving medicine would be worth a fortune. And greed in any era can lead to skullduggery. So that's what happens when they stumble across a body in the wonderful Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew.
Can you tell us a little bit about the corpse?
Yes. Well, it's, you know, why do Rexford and Sloan, you know, and Charlotte get involved? It's, well, Rexford's valet, Tyler, is old friends with one of the visiting scholars. And the scholar suspects that his colleague, who is about to announce a momentous discovery at the symposium, he suspects that he's been murdered. He's the one they find dead, and he did have a bad heart, but they notice, the scholar notices some white powder around his mouth. So he suspects that he's been murdered and that his formula and specimen plant for a new medicine have been stolen because it's nowhere to be found. Now, Charlotte and Rexford take friendships very seriously. So they agree when Tyler asks them to help, they reluctantly agree. And then when they begin to uncover clues that point to a larger, darker conspiracy, their own sense of justice compels them to bring the miscreants to justice.
We know from the book blurb that Rexford and Charlotte are planning their wedding, so that's not a spoiler in itself. I'm not going to ask you how they get there from him raging at her as A.J. Quill at the beginning of book one. But I would like you to talk a little bit about how they are well matched. I mean, they really are perfectly suited to each other, even though they're quite different. So what is it that draws them to each other?
It's a definite friends to lovers trope. I deliberately made them people who are very guarded with their emotions and don't easily let others in. So to me, building trust and mutual respect over time is really interesting. And I think it's more true to real life. The two of them are always going to butt heads, but in different ways as the relationship changes. And again, I think that's real life. Exploring how they grow and change with each other sort of gives me another layer of the series and the emotions that go on. One of the things I do find fun to play with is the matching of reason and intuition. They're both very, very careful observers, but they see things in different ways. And at first, they sort of butt heads on that, and they do come to respect each other, how they see things, how they process things, and they learn from each other, and they each begin, you know, Rexford begins to trust his intuition a little more, and Charlotte understands logic too, about being really analyzing things a little carefully. So it's really fun to work with them as I said, they learn a real respect and trust together.
What would you like people to take away from their Rexford and Sloan novels?
You know, I'm going to sort of answer that by going to my own childhood reading experiences. I mean, I found books magical, the power of storytelling, that sort of alchemy of words on paper that take you to wondrous places, introduce you to wondrous friends. It was transformational. And I discovered so many, you know, friends, Winnie the Pooh, Wind of the Willows, Charlotte's Web. What they all had in common was they sparked my imagination, encouraged a sense of curiosity, wonder, and adventure. I was one of those girls who wasn't very interested in girly things. And my storybook friends, you know, be they a bear, a badger, a mole, a knight, or other children, sort of helped me dare to think outside the box. And, you know, these books of quests and of courage in the face of fear, the power of friendship, the power of love, they were things that really shaped who I am as a writer. And it stuck with me. And so what do I want? I want readers to have fun being transported to my storybook world for a few hours. But I hope they also come away with that same elemental message that resonated with me from my childhood reading, that in the face of personal problems or misfortunes, we actually all have more courage and strength and resilience and wisdom than we think we have. So, if I manage to do that, I'm happy, and I hope my readers are too.
And you've already promised us more Lydia Ariana mysteries, which makes me very happy. Are we going to get another Rexford and Sloane as well?
We are indeed. The book 6 is already turned into my editor, and I've actually signed to do at least 3 more. So there will be more Rexford and Sloane.
Excellent. So thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Andrea. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Andrea Penrose about Murder at the Royal Botanic Gardens and its predecessors. Find out more about her at andreapenrose.com. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at New Books Network. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can find out more about me and my books at cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.